The world is not yet on track to avoid dangerous, irreversible climate change. But while the gravity of the task may appear daunting, there are plenty of positive signs that we can accelerate action to create thriving, sustainable societies. The interest is obvious. The ideas abound. The innovations exist or are currently being developed. And investments are increasing. So how do we harness this at scale in order to drive climate action? How can we expedite our path towards positive tipping points across key sectors of the economy? Welcome to Ahead of the Curve. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a diverse community of people passionate about creating positive impact. Throughout this series, produced in collaboration between The Conduit and Systemic, we'll bring to your attention some of the people, policies, organizations, and innovations that are creating positive tipping points we need for a net zero society. Our conversations with leading experts will reveal how climate action is already transforming economies, and they'll offer actionable insights into how we can move further faster to meet the objectives of the Paris Agreement. This episode is recorded at the Conduit Studio at COP26, and this series is produced in collaboration with Systemic, a B Corp dedicated to making economic systems regenerative and sustainable. We are, the average citizen, the most powerful trigger of tipping points. With the public fast acknowledging that climate change is a grave and imminent threat, is people's awareness of the threat of climate change matched by their actions as consumers? And can awareness and activism trigger rapid changes in government policy and to markets to the benefit of people and the planet? Jerome Foster II is an environmental activist, voting rights advocate, and emerging technology engineer. It's quite a combination. He sits on President Biden's White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council. He served as an intern for the civil rights campaigner John Lewis and served as a board member for the DC State Board of Education. He now serves as executive director of 1 Million of Us, which educates and mobilizes young people to register and to turn out to vote. Thank you for joining us today, Jerome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us about your journey. Everybody who does exceptional things in the world and turns out to be a mobilizer, an organizer, and an activist has a spark, a moment, or a series of experiences that placed them on the path to do what they do, as opposed to a sort of more conventional, less engaged, less public life. So what's your journey?
I think my journey starts with a sense of just connectedness with nature. Ever since I was a kid, I was always out in nature and just understanding how it functioned. And what drove me to climate activism and to activism in general was the fight for compassion, the fight for empathy. Me not being a victim of climate change in my local community, I still, as a person who's a part of the African diaspora, felt the pain of people all around the world and said, if I'm living in Washington, D.C., let's make sure this frustration that I'm feeling, this anxiety, is translated into policy action and translated into constructive activism. And that's kind of what led me to do whatever I could, whether that was through technology or through journalism or through organizing in the streets, to make our voice heard and to really fight for environmental justice.
And so let's start a little bit on the technology front. Tell us what you've done in that realm and how that bleeds into or influences your approach to activism.
For sure. I work in the emerging technology field, which includes virtual reality, augmented reality, and artificial intelligence. And from that framework, I started by trying to understand, how do we build empathy? Like I said, how I got into this movement. I was like, if I was powered by empathy, other people will be empowered by empathy as well. So I created virtuality environments where you step out of your own shoes and step into someone else's reality. You're able to be immersed into their experience of the world and seeing climate change impact everything around you. And being in a frontline community and living that experience and seeing that climate change isn't something in 2050, but something that's happening at this very moment. And that was where I started in technology, was there, and I continue to build and tell more stories and tell more nuanced intersectional ideas of what climate change really is. And through that, I began like organizing with movements and creating websites. And after a while, I was like, I can just help and help organize logistics. So it slowly became from being a coder at home who was always like on my computer for 10 hours a day to spending most of my time organizing logistics for climate strikes at the White House.
And did that happen slowly, organically, incrementally, or was there something that happened that sort of shifted you and said, I need to get out of coding for 10 hours a day all on my own to doing something that is more public facing and more, was there an event or something, or did it just sort of gradually build?
No, it was definitely a drastic shift. I was invited with National Geographic to do an expedition across the island and to tell the story in virtual reality. And it was 2 weeks, we were there, we were supposed to just capture the story of what was going on. But we were hiking on a glacier, Breiðamerkurjökull, which is the largest glacier in Iceland, and we did a hike there. We were going there, we're gonna do a VR experience and see what's happening, but as we hiked up, we saw that there were mounds of just soot and dust and dirt that was sitting on top of the glacier. And we were worried, we're like, if this doesn't reflect the sun, then it's gonna melt even faster, because if it doesn't have a white surface, it's gonna continue to absorb that heat and melt exponentially quicker. And as I was there sitting on that glacier, the route we took to get up there was no longer available for us to take down. That entire place had just fallen in. So we were like, how do we get off this glacier? We're sitting there for 10, 15 minutes thinking, this is not something that's happening gradually. This is happening literally right in front of our eyes. This glacier just crashed right here. It's not science fiction. It's not just something that's abstract. It's not numbers. It's lives. And that was like a real shift for me, because I understood that glacier that just fell might have been someone's life in Ghana or someone's life in Indonesia. And that directly correlated to that. And that was a real wake-up call for me to not just tell stories virtually, but to be on the ground in community, making sure our voices are heard and our demands are met.
In your bio, there is a reference to the great Congressman John Lewis. And you spoke a little bit about sort of intersectionality and how the climate movement and the quest for the imperfect and never-ending quest for racial justice are in fact intersecting and in fact are perfectly coherent as kind of twin struggles. Tell us a little bit about your work with the Congressman.
Absolutely. So a lot of people only know about my experience now as the White House advisor, but it's actually been a long journey in my community, just starting at DC State Board of Education, where I advocated for the inclusion of climate justice as a core subject across Washington, D.C. And unfortunately, I didn't pass, but I was like, I'm going to keep doing it. I'm going to keep persisting. So I applied to be an intern for Congressman John Lewis. And being a high schooler, that's like unheard of. Like, you're not supposed to be able to get a job there like at that young. But I was like, I'm going to do this. I don't care if it takes like a month for me to get this position. I want to make an impact. And luckily, on the first time I applied, they accepted. And ever since, I went on that first Friday, and I think it was February 1st, 2019, and I went into the office and I made my voice heard. We worked on climate economics. We worked on so many bills that I'd always wanted to work on and make a real impact. And that was kind of where I fell in love with like making policy language equitable and making it real and advocating for our demands to be actual policy implementations that impact change. And while I was there, that really changed my perspective on activism as well, because I understood, like, I had an intern on my right that was fighting for women's rights, and one on the left was fighting for criminal justice reform and fighting for so many movements. And we had intersectional conversations around the fact that we're fighting for the same justice, we're fighting for the same liberation, and we're fighting for the same just ability to be free in how we live and not have to be oppressed in every way that we operate in the world. And that came to the foundation of what we're fighting for is climate justice. You can't have any other social justice without climate justice. And the same is true. We all meet each other at the same intersection, fighting for how do we think about economics? How do we think about society? How do we think about culture and biocultural diversity? Because right now, everyone in the world lives in a Eurocentric way of living. We can only envision a way where we live in a house, two kids, and that's the end all. But really, there's so much biocultural diversity, indigenous way of living, and African way of living that lives in tune with nature. Sure, our current way of living works perfectly for Europe. That's the only place that it's working. And that's why Europe is the only place that has so much economic prosperity. Because one, they've taken from everyone else. And then two, we're living your model, which doesn't work for us. And that's really what environmental justice is about, is decolonizing our way of living and going back to Mother Earth and going back to the way in which we live in tune with nature, but also advancing in technology.
So I'm going to come to some of the detail of that in a moment, but I want to start for a moment about your kind of organizing infrastructure, like how you actually, what's your vision for building a movement and enabling people to organize and have their own voice? So, you know, in that famous parlance, there's nothing about us without us. Mm-hmm. How are you going about actually doing that today with the organization you're currently headed and working for?
Great, yeah. I organize three different organizations. One is called The Climate Reporter, which focuses on highlighting the movement and raising awareness of it in the media. I also run 1 Million of Us, which directly translates our power in the streets to the polls. And the real vision over the next few years of the climate strike movement is transitioning our streets power of like going and making our voices heard from the outside, pushing elected officials to do something, for us also uniting as negotiators and uniting as policymakers and policy advisors to advise in tandem with each other and work in a unified way that addresses the same demands that the movement is pushing for as well. And that's 1 Million of Us. That's a vision that I have, and also an organization I just now announced here at COP26. It's called Wake Up, water accessibility, empowering communities, uniting people, is all about how do we make sure water access is equitable. And that goes for even in global north countries where all across the US, water isn't accessible. So that's my theory of change, is honing in on politics and voting power, then also honing in on access to water and access to clean land.
So in terms of the kind of hard policy work, because I think that to me is one of the most interesting questions for what I've experienced at COP. There is this remarkable set of youth activists, you amongst them, who are emerging. There was a group of 9 exceptional women on stage, convened by Emma Watson in the first week of COP, and you know they were the sort of youth climate avengers. And you know, if they'd had an equivalent one for men, you'd be on that stage as well. And the articulation of the rage and the anxiety and the forcefulness is clear. When you get into the room and maybe into office and into policymaking, translating the power of the street and the force of organizing into now we want A, B, C, D, and E, and this is how we're going to do it, has always been the challenge for social justice movements. So tell us how you think that transition ought to happen, and what's your vision for that?
My vision for the transition is how do we center around the next decade around meaningful investments and meaningful transportation infrastructure investments, and also a change in how we operate as an economy. Right now, our economy is only focused on growth and only focused on profit, but we have to bake in a system that focuses on development and focuses on equitable growth and not just extractive growth. That's a real vision that I have. And for policy, we have to depoliticize and departisanize how we talk about climate and actually get to the root of tree equity and get to the root of actually how do we center nature in our conversations, and also conversations around public transport and not just continual investments in private EVs, but also in public high-speed rail investment, which could actually transform how we go around our countries. Because in the 1970s, 1940s, 1950s, America made investments in our highways, even in unprofitable areas like in rural places. Right now, that's what's needed in this next decade, is for the federal government and for countries around the world to make unprofitable investments in rural communities where people don't have the economic means to buy a car for transportation to more economically prosperous regions. And that goes on the behalf of governments. That's something that can be environmentally friendly. And things like that, that's my vision, is not just looking out for investments in what's already great, because oftentimes people figure out a way to insulate themselves from the climate crisis. It's vulnerable communities that need government support and need public investment that is most at risk. That's what government must focus on, and not just New York City and San Francisco and Washington, D.C.
So I want to ask you a question about your theory of change and mobilizing power. You clearly don't want people just to go out in the streets, protest, raise their voices. go home. You want that to translate into the halls of power. You've lived that experience yourself, and you've just articulated in a very clear way how you want that to translate into policy. The United States is a strange place because you've just had the first president of color. Then you had a president who was a climate denialist, incredibly divisive, authoritarian bents, and arguably a terrible racist. And now you've had a president who is trying to put questions of climate at the center of a COVID recovery plan, is sensitive and attentive to questions of racial justice. And we have a social media world where we've never been more fragmented, more divided, more polarized. People don't speak the same language. The level of climate denialism in the United States is extraordinary. The division between red states and blue states and Republicans and Democrats has never seemed more greater. Is your theory of change that what you want to do is mobilize the disempowered, the non-voting, the disenfranchised, and win with 51-52% of the poll every time by bringing them into politics? Or do you want to simultaneously try and reach out and convert people on the other side of the partisan design? And can you do both?
I think that that's a both and. I want to unpack that because I was like, I think two different questions,
yep.
Maybe three.
maybe
but I'll tackle the last question first about how do we reach out to people.
Yeah.
I think that as progressives and as people that are fighting for real change, I see that reaching out to non-voters is also the same as reaching out to people on the other side, because they see if we're able to pass investment in their communities that actively helps their neighborhoods, then they'll see that, oh, wait, progressives are looking out for me too. This isn't a Democrat issue. This is a human issue. I think we don't have to always just argue with the other side. We can just bring them in through the example of our leadership. And that's like the most powerful form of a persuasion, is showing them what we can do. And I think tackling your next question around digital like fragmentation and how we operate online and how different that is to real life, I think that there's also a sense of non-genuineness, I guess, on online. And I think that is tied to the fact that we have to have some form of verifying our identity online. We have to have that tied to the person. I think that will change our politics for sure, because people feel a greater sense of freedom and rebelliousness online to be just stoke just I guess just arguments when really there isn't one. And that's kind of the solution would be, just to be more real and to have someone be accountable to that account and to that comment. And your first question, if I think you remind me, is about more about red states and blue states and why we had Trump, and then we had Obama, then we had Trump, and now we have Biden. I think there's a pendulum to democracy. It sways to a phase, an era of progressive change, and then sometimes it sways back to repressive bigotry that we saw with Trump. And I think it's coming back to that era of positive change, because people had a vision, and they saw how terrible that bigotry era was, and we said, no, we don't want that. We are progressing into the future. That bigotry is no longer welcome here. And we want actually inclusiveness and progressive policies. And I think we'll continue to see that pendulum swing wherever we go. The voting is a sword that cuts through all injustice, as we say. It's voting that prevents that pendulum from swinging so far back to a Trump-like figure.
So I hope you're right. What I think is interesting about having this conversation here in Europe from COP is, if you look, for example, at the German elections, within the main strands of the German political establishment, with perhaps the exception of the kind of far-right AfD, most parties have climate of some form in their agenda. Some are more market-oriented, some are more state top-down, some are more aggressive on carbon taxes, some are more in favor of green investments and entrepreneurship, etc. But there's no real debate or discussion about, is climate change real? Is it an existential threat, and do we have to tackle it? It's how you tackle it. And the debate is really about the best way to tackle climate change amongst all the various parties. They're all sort of different shades of green in tackling the problem.
Yes.
The trick in the US is you go from, we really need to tackle it, to it isn't even a problem and it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And as you've so eloquently said in other places, kind of, we're out of time. We don't have time for the pendulum to go back to another 4 years of denial. And so it does mean that The urgency to act in the US, I would argue, as the world's second largest polluter and the biggest economy, is we can't afford for that pendulum to go back the other way. And so I'm interested in sort of what's the language that you use to be inclusive and to bring people over? Because I think it's not red or blue, it's human, and how we affect you is so powerful and so important. But I sense you have more to give in terms of how you reach out across the aisle and bring those people onto the side of climate justice.
Sure, if we really have like honest conversations about how we reach out to people, it's oftentimes just talking to them about what they've been struggling with. Like when we go to the Midwest and we talk to people that are around like Ohio or Oklahoma, we see that in Oklahoma they had 100 earthquakes because of fracking. Before fracking wasn't there, they had 2 earthquakes a year. Now they have 126, 108, 109 over the past years. That's not a Democrat issue. That's not a Republican issue. That's them suffering, and they need someone to save them because their homes are at risk. And when we go and talk to them about what change they need, we don't even talk about Republican or Democrat. Like, my organization is nonpartisan because we truly believe that's like, that's just figments of political division, that if there was no party, like Lincoln said, not to create parties in the United States, we'd have honest conversations about the fact that climate change is not fake. It's not a fictitious thing that we come up with. It's about the conversation shouldn't even be there anymore because no one honestly believes that. Even Republicans, when I talk to them in closed rooms, they understand the reality of it, but they're fearful that their voters will kick them out of office if they're honest. But this is not the time to be scared. It's the time to have the fortitude and bravery to speak truth. And your voters will actually appreciate that because you're finally being truthful with them. Like Republicans all across America are so not in tune with politics and are so skeptical of big industry because of the fact that their politicians aren't being truthful to them because they're scared of them. We have to change in how we talk to the other side of the aisle because they aren't on the other side of the aisle. We just haven't talked to them. We haven't connected with them on a human scale.
So I completely agree with you that climate, tornadoes, floods, earthquakes, they affect everybody, and they affect often the poor and the most marginal more and worse. Mm-hmm. But you can build an argument to say we all have a collective interest in dealing with climate change. And if you articulate it with the language you do, I'm cautiously optimistic that you can reach across a divide. I want to ask you that same question in the context of racial injustice, because that one is a little different. It's people of color who get targeted, who get stopped and frisked, who get shot at when their cars are pulled over, who die disproportionately at the hands of law enforcement. And you can't make quite the same argument to a 19-year-old white man and a 19-year-old black man that you're equally at risk. You're just not equally at risk. But on the other hand, if we're wanting to get racial justice and we're wanting to vote in a series of policies that cause the police to act more responsibly, that get effective people as sheriffs and law enforcement officers in place, that allocate resources not just to weapons but to mental health and to homelessness, you need to reach across the aisle in that same way again. But that's a harder job because it's not necessarily the experience of white people. So I'm sure you've thought deeply about that, but what's the language we use and what's the strategy there?
The strategy around racial justice and how that intersects with environmentalism is the fact that we have to understand what system we're trying to fight against. It's the system of extractivism, the system of colonialism. Even though it was 400 years ago, the foundation of our economics was built on that. And that goes to how even back in the day, we used slave labor for people to power our economy. Now we use the extraction of nature as the foundation of that. And that's an immediate through line in how we talk about climate and how we talk about racial justice. Because right now, people of color are, and indigenous people are in the same position as nature. Indigenous people have been driven to almost extinction, and black people have been ravaged so much that we're still trying to recover. Nature's in the same position. Some species are almost at extinction, and others are ravaged so much that they're still trying to recover, but there's no place to heal. We have to come to the table and say, how do we heal systemically? Because as you talked about how people are stopped and frisked, it's not just about the individual incident. It's about a system and a pattern of consistent intent to harm. That's what we're trying to change, is change the culture of of why is our systems and our finance systems built around not investing in Black communities? Why are over 80% of coal-fired power plants placed in Black communities? Why are so much of the infrastructure burden and pollution burden on Black people? And it's like, it's because our finance systems are built like that. That's how we have to have conversations, is how do we make a framework of society that's more equitable and more safe for people? It shouldn't be, well, Black people have been redlined for 40 years, so now that land is cheaper, so now we can place 5 factories here because it's economically more profitable for us to get there, and that helps our bottom line. From that argument, you aren't being racist from some perspective, but actually you are, because you're reinforcing a system of disproportionate harm. And now as we talk about COVID-19, people are saying, oh, well, now we have pre-existing conditions. People with pre-existing conditions are at the front lines. That's Black people, because we are already at pre-existing conditions of being exposed to toxins like CO2 emissions and nitric oxide and so many other chemicals that harm us. That's how everything continues to compound upon itself, and how climate change gets to the root of these systems of oppression. It's about that conversation has to change. And that means policy change. That means money. Because budgets are moral documents. Budgets are where our morals are. And budgets say, oh, we're going to allocate to actively decolonialize our economic and political systems.
So how do you're a White House advisor, for goodness sake. So you genuinely have a seat at the table. And when you're making the arguments, as you so eloquently did, that budgets are moral documents, you have an unusually powerful interlocutor, somebody on the other side who's listening, or hopefully listening. How much resonance are you getting when you make these sorts of arguments within the White House?
I think some people are still, like, as soon as I joined the White House, everyone lumped me into a politician-like box. But I'm still very much an activist in the White House, so when I'm in these conversations, I tend to get into activist mode where I say, hey, we need to actually make some change. We can't just sit here and talk about and just grandstand and give speeches and have me sit here for 5 hours and talk about what you're going to do. I'm coming here to send solutions, and if you're going to do them, let's do them. And I think that's what has changed in the White House around the 7 months I've been there, is we've created the Justice 40 Initiative, where the federal government has committed to a whole government approach where every federal agency must commit to 40% of their entire budget go to environmental justice benefits to frontline communities. And their everyday operations have to go to making sure that this climate crisis is not only helping communities that are already able to insulate themselves, but actually at the front lines. So that's one of the key areas that I'm making real change at the White House, is by advising there. The second is by making sure that we have a climate and economic justice screening tool, where when companies go across the nation and where people try to get insight on what's happening, people have a transparent system that they can go in and see where emissions are being emitted, where trees are being planted, and where pipelines are being built. Like, that's a transparency toolkit that we need to build, and that has what we proposed to President Biden, is by making a transparent and equitable and actually easy way for people to see what climate change and climate justice actually means. Because we can talk about our progress, but people can't see it because it's oftentimes too abstract for people to relate to it. So that's kind of my work in the White House, but there's 4 years more to go. I'm excited to see what these next 6 months look like, because our recommendations are supposed to go into implementation phases then.
So part of what we're trying to do in this episode is talk about positive tipping points. Mm-hmm. And this series has looked at a whole series of tipping points that are moving us towards rapid, accelerated change in the direction of net zero, in the direction of economic justice, in the direction of climate justice. And we've spoken up to now in kind of technical terms, regenerative agriculture, the electrification of transport grids, smart grids, battery technologies, renewables. And what I'm interested in is what you're doing as a positive tipping point. And so my hypothesis is that you embody a movement that is spreading across the world of young people engaged, mobilized, seats at the table, asserting voice and agency, political power, increased sophistication in how you engage with that. And that is going to be a necessary condition, because policy relies on politics, and politics relies on you guys mobilizing and winning. And so you are, in fact, one of those positive tipping points. So I wonder, A, do you think of yourself in those terms? And if you do, what's your vision for making sure that there's not just one of you, but there's tens of thousands of you who are organizing tens of millions of people to be a coherent political force?
Yeah, for us to be, as you said, a coherent political force that articulates real change, we have to have continual presence at the ballot box and have continual presence whenever a politician makes speeches, because if we aren't an active and engaged, as President Obama says, citizenry, then we'll be left behind. We'll be not included in these policy decisions. In order for us to be, as you said, the tens of thousands of people that are in office, we have to actually make sure that this one person that I am right now that's in office translates into real change. Like, if we are here in the next 4 years, make a positive impact, then they'll see, oh, young people are valuable. We need more of them here. And right now, actually, I'm working on that same idea, and is creating a youth advisory council at the White House and creating an office of young Americans at the White House and also at the UN scale to have a body of young people that politicians can look to and say, what is your moral approach to this? What is your expertise on this? And we have an active conversation and dialogue about what intergenerational action looks like. Because oftentimes they invite us to speak here at COP26 in the plenary, but it's to an empty room. It's to an unengaged room. It's to them saying, we're giving you a space to speak to the public, but we've already galvanized the public. The public is listening. It's time for them to listen and for them to actively implement our voices at policy. And that only comes from us just continuing to organize and continue to be in the streets while also being everywhere else.
I mean, I think that there is a very strong moral argument to say that if you're under 30, you should have two votes and everybody over 30 should only have one vote. Because this is the first time in history that if you're under 30, your time horizon is really at risk. Now, we're never going to get that through in any democratic system, we know. But there is a way of getting that through as a proxy, which is to have people under 30 vote at twice the rate and show up at twice the rate than other people do. And in some ways, that gets you your two votes. And I think you organizing like that and in that way with both the intelligence and with the passion that you do gives me great hope. And I'm so incredibly grateful that you've joined us today. And there will be tens of thousands of people who will watch this. Just do a shout out for your work, your organization, so people can look it up. And there are other young people who are wanting to do similar works in their own communities. They can kind of look at that and see you as something to emulate or a role model. So Absolutely. This is your shout out time.
So there are three ways for people to get involved. If you're a journalist or wanting to raise awareness of what's happening in your community around climate or social justice, you can reach out to the Climate Reporter and be a writer. If you're interested in transitioning our movement power into active voting impact, then reach out to 1 million of us to organize a movement of millions of young people to get out in the streets and vote. And if you're interested in focusing on water accountability and access in communities, reach out to Wake Up. And any other way, just reach out to other orgs around you and start a climate strike wherever you are.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've just listened to The Voice of the Future. Thank you for listening to this episode of Ahead of the Curve, produced in partnership with Systemic, who are addressing the world's biggest challenges with new solutions for the benefit of business, society, and the planet. Find out more about Systemic at systemic.earth. You can connect with The Conduit and our community of changemakers by visiting theconduit.com. This podcast series is available on The Conduit's website and on all major podcast platforms on the Conduit Conversations channel.